Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today we've pulled in one of our favorite guests, Mr. Matt Finch of Mythmira Games, to help think through how much real mythology is good to inject in your fantasy campaign world. You know, Matt's World of Jordoba setting is getting an update soon, so we're going to talk about that and a whole lot more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get started with today's conversation with Matt, I'll remind everyone, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our private Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to the Discord server. Get your account all set up over there on Discord before the end of the show, because at about 10 to 15 minutes after the show is over, we'll be there to chat with you all live.
We love that part of our week. We just have the best patrons over there. Big thanks to our patrons like Backwiz, who's currently checking in that we are now live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream Bots. Thank you so much for that. Now, just in case someone doesn't know who Matt Finch of Mythmira Games is, I'm just going to point out that Matt's legal expertise basically helped establish the old school renaissance. He created the Swords and Wizardry game. He's co-creator of Osric, the old school primer, the Tome of Adventure design that you see us using all the time here, and a whole lot more. So, Matt, thank you so much for making time to join us today.
I always love being on this show.
We love hanging out with you. We love hanging out with your partner in Mythmira Games, Susie. So hopefully we can get her on in the future. You know, so a thing that occurred to me recently that I think I need both your guys' help on personally as a little bit of a therapy session is, I'm wondering how much real-world mythology can we borrow or reference in our fantasy worlds? And on the one hand, a pro that occurs to me is it's nice to have stuff that my players can immediately recognize and kind of have a gut instinct for how this interacts with the world and how this interacts with people and their characters. But the con is, if you start pulling at it, how much sense does it make to disentangle that stuff from the real-world people and places that actually generated it? And at some point, someone can start criticizing that. And I guess sometimes I wrestle with that. I'm wondering how you guys have resolved that in your campaign world.
Well, I mean, the first thing is that's more of a concern. The disentangling it from the real world is more of a concern for a publisher than it is for a game table with just, you know, a bunch of people who are playing a game. And so it's fairly important for a publisher. I think it's virtually not important at all, you know, if it's just, you know, at your game table. And when I was doing my thinking about this show, I tracked exactly with what you were talking about. But point number one, that your players need, it's useful to have a referent in the player's head, in their imagination, and that's why you use things from the real world. If I say that someone is a knight, they're going to see a person in armor. If I say he's a cataphract, that may not have the same power behind it, and even there, we're going to history, because that's a chainmail armored, knight, basically. But, using things that the players can latch onto to assemble their own vision of what's going on in the world is really important. And I think that the downside risk for somebody other than me who's not a publisher is not so much getting tied into the real world. It is that if you're throwing out too many new concepts all at once into a campaign or a world setting, your players can come adrift very quickly. I mean, this is the very common problem that DMs have, where, you know, I wrote, you know, a 30-page gazetteer for the campaign for my players, and none of them read it. Well, no, they're probably not gonna. And so they're just, you know, you're assuming a level of knowledge on the part of the players. Players do not, you know, they're there to play. They're not there to spend a lot of attention span on picking up ideas that, you know, that you Tolkien'd out, you know, over the weekend designing, you know, four different, you know, new languages. So that's the I think the real trade-off for people who aren't publishers, you know, just at the gaming table, is that question about I have a referent and I don't have a referent. So, you know, I think it strongly militates toward the idea of use a fair amount from real history, anything that your players are going to be able to latch onto. But then the question is that, you know, the downside is there's nothing new in this campaign. This is just a historical, you know, thing. Where's the magic? Where's the new stuff? Where's the Conan? Where's the Clark Ashton Smith? Where's the Jack Vance? You know, what's here that's going to excite me because it's brand new and I've never seen it before.
Side question: Did you just use the verb Tolkien'd? Did you mean like Tolkien, like as in a computer system of bits of information, or did you mean Tolkien like J.R.R. Tolkien doing something?
J.R.R. Tolkien.
Okay, new verb for Dan.
I don't even live in a world where token has anything to do with technology. A token is a thing that you know give to somebody in exchange for something, or it's something that represents something. The whole AI use of the word token is you know, I only just you know started using a cell phone a few years ago, so that'll give you an idea.
All right,
Dan, you're expecting good company. I was expecting you to call it the third usage, right? Of like a small piece used on a board game, like a bead of glass or...
I didn't even think about that. That's really funny. Anyway, new verb dropped, and I'm very excited about it. I will say that Paul did, you know, so like what I was thinking of, like the struggle that some fantasy writers have of like how many italicized in-world terms do you have? Like, do you have to have, like, if I look at one page of your fantasy novel, is like half of the text all going to be italicized foreign languages? Or is there going to be like three really critical eldritch terms that I'm going to run into through the novel or something like that? And I do feel like my limit is relatively low. And, you know, we're playing in English, or some kind of natural, you know, some kind of real world natural language. And so fundamentally the words and the phrases and the terms are something that we're taking from actual Earth a large percentage of the time. And right off the bat, that stuff is going to be framing what your world like. I will say Paul did find one clever way of getting at least one player to read the entirety of his world's backstory. Remind me, Paul, how you...
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Well, you had one player that did actually read the backstory, and then at some point when there was a puzzle in the game, they had to that one person could answer it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was a very specific instance where it was actually some content from my campaign that I had brought to a convention, and so it was like lifted out of the campaign, and I think honestly, I just passed it out as like, hey, you know, you have these three ancient tablets that you read that led you to this location. That's how you got here. And then I handed them out as handouts. Here's three pages of text. And I said, it's not important. You don't need to read it, whatever. But if you're interested, you can. Here you go. And sure enough, it came up later in the game. And he had the information at his fingertips because one player had read it. I don't know, Dan, was that anything more than dumb luck, though? You think that I had some very clever scheme in mind when I handed out those pages?
I mean, going forward, I'm going to say in my games, there will be a quiz later. I'm going to give out campaign backgrounds. There will be a quiz later.
As I recall, it wasn't even a planned thing, right? That was simply a case of the party encountered a Sphinx, and I was trying to come up with off the cuff a riddle for the Sphinx to ask. And I was like, I'm going to ask something about the history of the world that it's in, because that's fun. And they'll know if they bother to read those pages I handed out. But yeah, it was. I wish I could say that I was clever enough to have foreseen all of the steps that would have gotten us there, and then machinated that whole thing from the beginning.
But I mean, the thing is too, though, that you get some players. You know, it's usually the ones who play the magic users and the clerics. Some players love getting deep, deep, deep into the background of the campaign. So, you know, on average, I would say players have no interest in doing the homework. Some are fascinated by that stuff and really want that, and they like the depth in the campaign. So I usually do, because I think this way, you know, I just go ahead and write it down, you know, the stuff about the background, you know, on the campaign. And then for those that are interested in it, you know, they've got something that they can start getting their hooks into, you know, to get more and more knowledge about what's going on. And then, but it's, you know, for those that are not interested in it, you know, they'll leave it to the cleric and magic user characters to know what's in the gazetteer and tell them if need be, you know, that that's something that they'll hang you for in this city, you know.
That's a funny observation, actually, and that matches. Like, I don't mind, you know, the radically different play styles in classic D&D of the wizard player has to commit to having a big book and reading through the big descriptions of the spells to know what they're going to do. And the fighter is like, I know what a sword is. I bang someone over the head with it. That's I don't need a whole lot more. I don't need to do a lot of reading. So it's a good point that the wizard, that's an interesting observation. The wizard players are likely already geared for that kind of interaction. Now I will say that, okay, so I do think that if I'm borrowing a bunch of real world stuff, I do, likewise, not every player, not most players, but I do think that there's the capacity for me to run into one or two particularly critically minded, well, actually players at the table. And I'll confess, I might be that person. I might be the person at the table that actually is a little bit, has a little bit of a cringe, and an example that I can think of is frankly Paladins, and I might be a little bit extra sensitive to this because my middle name's Roland, for what it's worth. But frankly, when I hear Paladin, I go, is this one of the 12 peers of Charlemagne? That's what a Paladin is. It's the 12 elite knights in Charlemagne's court, specifically in the 800s of France. How did this person come from Charlemagne's court?
Willing suspension of disbelief can be a problem for you. Is that the?
It can be a problem for me. I usually don't verbalize it. I don't know if anybody sees the little twitch that I have, but I'm still a little bit, did that really work? Does that work? I'm not sure about that because words mean something in my opinion. So I do think there are some players, or maybe it's just me, that actually will run up against a bit of a boundary in those cases.
It's interesting, Dan. I think that you have like this potential. You know, there's a yin to this yang, right? Of like the player who just doesn't even know the word, has never heard of it, and you're expecting, you throw something out that comes from, you know, history or mythology or whatnot, and expect that to carry some weight. And then you end up with the stories of like the player who attacks the gazebo, right? Like, well, it is a monster, obviously, of some sort. I attacked the gazebo because I've never heard that word before.
Well, I have. Okay. And right. And I have run into that, you know, accidentally. And one example would be like the coinage, right? So the coinage in my world is silver pieces are groats and gold pieces are nobles. And those are just actual English coins. And, you know, I've had one of my really dedicated, really great players hear that for the first time and like, oh, how, what an interesting exotic coinage system that Dan's invented for this world, and jot, you know, take notes down rather carefully about how, what the coinage is like, as if, and I, you know, accidentally pretend, you know, accidentally having looked like I've created this really deep campaign world when I'm just stealing bits like that. So it can go in both directions. So Matt, the part of the thing that threw me onto this line of thinking is you have a new edition for your fantasy campaign, The World of Jordoba. You've written a couple of things in the past about it, and you have a new update to that coming up, I think in about 3 weeks now. I get the first full week of July. I think you've got a backer kit for that. And you pointed out that on DriveThruRPG right at the moment, You have a really lovely...
And I'm going to interrupt you here. I'm going to interrupt you here and point out that we're experiencing a small technical problem. This is a first for Wandering DMs, and it does look like we've dropped Matt's call. So I don't think you can hear anything saying.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah. We're going to have to vamp for a bit here in hopes that Matt rejoins
us. Got it. So hopefully, I mean, when that happens to me, I refresh the browser. Hopefully, and that usually reconnects. Let me...
I'll try to get a hold of Matt, Dan.
Right.
let's try to not let the show go off the rails.
Sorry about that. Yeah, fortunately, that's never happened in the past. Okay, so anyway, so as Paul connects to Matt there, hopefully gets him reconnected soon. I will point out to our viewers that Matt does have a new edition of his World of Jordoba setting coming up. That is one of the things I really wanted to ask him about here today on the show. And in the YouTube show, we do have links to his upcoming backer kit in a couple weeks. Matt is back. I think you can hear us, yes?
You hear me?
Oh, yes. Oh, now we can. Now we can. Fantastic. You're back.
Yeah, we had a...
Oh, no!
He's back.
Had a power outage here with the internet went down.
Good.
He seems to be back.
Getting back.
Good it's job amazing that back. In season 8, this is the first time this has ever happened to us. And maybe, Dan, afterwards, you and I will sit down and talk about what do we do when suddenly our guest loses connection. But Dan, please, let's rewind a quick 30 seconds here and pose your question again that Matt, I'm sure.
So, Matt, I was, I was introducing a little bit about your upcoming World of Jordoba update. And I was telling our viewers that you got a backer kit for the new edition of that coming out in about 3 weeks or so, first full week of July. And you have a lovely player's guide that's currently on DriveThruRPG for zero cost. And we're talking about how few players want to read a long backstory. We love pets. We're big dog, cat, friends, everything on the show. So bring your dogs, bring your cats. We love them. And you have a lovely player's guide on DriveThruRPG right at the moment. That's a comic book. That's a short 6-page comic book by a great, made by a great artist that does work for Dark Horse Studios, if I recall. And gets the point real nice, lovely. And one of the things that I saw in that is that in your World of Jordoba, you have an Atlantis. You have an Atlantis that was a legendary island city that sank. And I'm wondering what made you feel that that was useful or that you could get away with that in your fantasy world?
Well, I mean, getting away with it is not a problem because it was first mentioned by Plato. So that's, Atlantis has not got very much, intellectual property, locked up. But it was a decision very much along the lines that we were talking about, that if you say Atlantis, people instantly have a picture in their head. And in Jordoba, Atlantis did not sink, but it broke up into several islands and stuff between them sank. But that's one of the things. I mean, what Jordoba is based on, because it's a living world, it's not really very good for a single elevator pitch. But the idea is it's based on comic book swords and sorcery. And it is sort of more, and for that reason, it's got more of a Bronze Age, Iron Age feel to it than a regular medieval thing, although it's at a medieval level of technology. I mean, there's steel, there's stirrups. I'm not trying to create a Bronze Age, simulation game. This is not what D&D would look like if it was in the Bronze Age. It's just this has got more of the cultures are more Bronze Age, the magic is more Conan. So it's really, it's comic book sword and sorcery is really the quick elevator pitch to it. And Atlantis fits in really well there. In fact, Atlantis even shows up in the famous, introductory lines in Howard's Conan, in the days before Atlantis sank. So there's Atlantis in there. I mean, I think one of the things that we're tracing around, both with the Roland, the thoughts about, you know, paladins and Roland, and then the question about, you know, here's a general setting, is what's the point in the first place of even having a world setting? I mean, that's question number one. I think a lot of us played without one when we very first started out, except for Paul, because there were commercial ones all available by the time that Paul started gaming. But at the very beginning, those weren't really out there. Judges Guild did really the first one, and it was very scattershot and difficult to find. And if you bought all this stuff, it would have been really expensive. But it wasn't until the World of Greyhawk. And so a lot of us just sort of like went from dungeon to dungeon. You know, here's the, you know, the setting of the Hill Giant Chief. I don't know. It's in the hills somewhere. And so, the, you know, your number one question is, what is even the point of using a world setting? And I think most people would argue that it adds a lot. But I think that when you're in the process of designing a world setting, it's worth going back to the very initial question of why am I doing this? I'm not just because everybody's got one is not really a great reason necessarily, not when you're designing your own. You want to be thinking a little bit more about why you're doing it.
Yeah, and I, you know, like as soon as you start talking about wilderness adventures, like you need a place to go. Like, where are you going to go and what does it look like?
Right. And what's in between doesn't matter that much, but you've got to have a point A and a point B and a reason to go from point A to point B.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's that. I mean, I mean, some of us do enjoy hex crawl explorations of like what is all the territory in the middle. But that's a good point too. You know, I was reading this morning, I was reading the Instigator of the Thieves World series, right? And at the outset, they had that exact same thesis that started the Thieves World series. And I guess they were having a conversation about it in 1978 of like every one of our fantasy writer friends has to sit down and beat their head against making a whole world for their fantasy world. Maybe we could assist people and take that repetitive work off the table and just make one single shared world that we'll write all these anthology stories in and make it specifically so we don't all have to keep reinventing that wheel over and over again. Yeah. So it is in question motivating in the first place.
I should go back and say I wasn't dissing on hex crawls when I was talking about what's in between. But from the campaign, you know, it doesn't, if it's hills, it's hills. If it's plain, it's plain, you know, going through the various terrain types. But what the world setting adds is more of a story element. Why are we going to this place?
Yeah.
We've gone through hills, through hills, through hills. Aha, this is the Pass of Joaris through the Atropos Mountains. We have achieved a milestone. I think that milestones are one of the things that pure flavor story really does actually add. Even if you're as old school can be and you're just playing it to beat the default setting and whatever it might be, the feeling of achievement at getting through, we're now past, you know, we're in the dungeon, we've gotten past the gates of the demon. This is going to be new on the other side of it. It is a new thing. We're excited about exploring that. We've gotten to the Pass of Joaris. We're crossing the Atropos Mountains. We've achieved something by getting there. And, you know, that's one of the, you know, now granted, you know, behaviorally that may be a rat hitting a food bar, but it really works. You know, it's one of the rewards that the players get is feeling that they've actually done a thing. And that's not something that comes out of the rules except for leveling up. So it's an additional thing from outside the throw in there that gives them, you know, that makes it more of a, you know, a sword and sorcery or a fantasy or whatever approach. It makes it feel like you're moving through an epic adventure because you've got these things to hang meaning onto.
That's great. Paul, what were you going to say there?
To take a little stab at Matt's question of like, why do we even have a setting, right? It's to create that shared context, right? That shared language that we can use as a starting point when we discuss what's going on in the world or what's going on with our characters or whatnot. And I might argue that even in the early days before there was packaged settings, there was still the beginnings of that, which is, I will just strongly point at Appendix N, right? A list of inspirational works. What is that if not a setting, or at least an attempt to create that shared background of this is what we're anticipating is going to be in the game.
Nice. Let me throw up a comment from one of our viewers at the moment. So Mysterious JGM was saying a minute ago, I think most people are just, where are the pirates at? Where's the lost city in the jungle? Are there Vikings? And even in the earliest original D&D books, you know, there's little comments of like, well, if you're going to hire a hireling who's an elf or a dwarf, that's going to cost extra because you have to send message runners over to Elfland or Dwarfland. And that immediately starts me like, where's Elfland and Dwarfland and how far away are they? And that seems interesting and evocative to me. So there's a lot of reasons why you want to establish that up front.
Yeah, I think so. And here let's split off the ideas of, because we've been talking about the reason for making a campaign world if you're homebrewing your own. The question that got asked about where are the pirates, where is the lost city in the jungle, there we're talking, you know, now I'll put on my publisher hat, which I'm literally wearing my publisher hat. and you know, that's part of the job when you're putting something together, is to provide Paul's joint unification of vision on the part of the players, is to provide the information, where is the lost city, where are the pirates. It sort of puts stuff into order, and so that's why and we're doing a player gazetteer that will be a lot shorter and contain a lot fewer of the secrets about the campaign, to give the players the sort of direction there's a map, a great big map, so people can look at the map and be like, ah, what's over here? Maybe we want to go over here. And so it jump starts a lot of the work that you would have to do yourself as the DM if you homebrew the world. And frankly, there's an old saying that I love, that no one is a prophet in their own hometown. You could be the best. If J.R.R. Tolkien sat down with a bunch of folks at the Inklings and was like, okay, let's play D&D, I'm going to be the DM, he'd be like, okay, so here's, you know, Elvish. There's two types of Elvish. And they'd be like, you know, J.R.R., where are the pirates? And we want to go to a lost city in the jungle. So just, you know, skip all of this stuff about the different languages. You know, no one's a prophet in their own hometown. So by having a package deal of, here's a big poster map you can spread out, here's a little guess here, it's official looking. It was, you know, it came from outside, and you can, you know, you can ride on the credibility of that as the DM to, and then you can proceed to make that world into whatever it is that you want to make it into, with your players being none the wiser, you know, and in their mind, it's got the imprimatur, you know, of being by an official publisher, which nice. Is really nice. Useful sometimes. Truly useful.
I just want to say I love the idea of having separated out like the presentation of the worlds or the setting to players versus the DMs, right? And having that strikes me as very like, immediately reminded of like the old like Pinnacle stuff, like the original Deadlands and such, where there was definitely like, there are secrets in this world, and like there's a definite break in the book of like, players should stop reading at this point because now we're gonna give all the stuff that you're supposed to discover over the course of play, which I think really speaks to like, and I think we see this in early D&D, where to begin with, we've chucked a whole bunch of monsters in the monster list that come straight out of mythology, so everyone will immediately recognize like, yep, it's a Medusa, it's a, you know, it's a griffin, whatever, we all know what that is. And then eventually you get to the players kind of maybe knowing too much, and now the DMs are trying to like trick them, and you get stuff like, well, now I'm going to add rot grubs, or now I'm going to add, right, all these weird things so that there's something new to discover and new to challenge the players. What an interesting push-pull I think that is of like you want the players bought in to know a little bit about the setting, but not too much, because you want there to be stuff for them to discover through play.
Well, it was a couple
that of things. That was how we started out.
Yeah. I'll point out that, I'm sorry, Matt. A couple weeks ago, we had a show on Eldritch Wizardry, and we're at the 50th anniversary of those supplements like Eldritch Wizardry and the Gods and Demigods book. And you get Tim Kask in the foreword explicitly saying what Paul just said is the players know too much about D&D, and we really want this stuff to be DM only to keep surprising them.
Right. And also going back to Paul's other point is that's the reason that we ended up with this comic book. And like I said, you know, there's 3 pages of it out now in the sort of teaser thing to get people to go and sign up for the pre-launch. And then when if BackerKit works properly using this whole thing, we'll do a complete version. Whenever somebody pledges, they'll be able to go through and get the full 6 pages that we've done. But the reason that we started with the comic book is the picture's worth 1,000 words. For a player introduction to a campaign, I don't think anyone's going to have any trouble reading 6 pages of comic book. And that will get them into the feel of this is what things look like, because there's the pictures, here's the description of the, you know, the city of Jordoba, so you know where you're going to be, and it gets you way farther, a lot more easily than... you know, I've just printed out, you know, pages on my home computer. If you know, this is a comic book, anyone will read a comic book. So, you know, that's part of what was going into the thinking on that, is it's a very rapid introduction to the world.
I thought that was really clever. It kind of reminds me of like Tom Wham would do with some of his games, Awful Green Things from Outer Space. He'd have a 1 or 2 page comic introduction. And I still remember that so strongly. The combination of the images and the text, I remember like practically every panel like really strongly as a result. So I haven't seen this for other fantasy world type stuff, but boy, I thought it was really clever as soon as you pointed it out to me. It's interesting.
Let me ask a question, Matt. I'm just kind of curious if you can talk about this or at this point or not, but like, Is the main publication of Jordoba expected to then be purely for the DM? Is the players supposed to limit themselves to just these couple of panels of comic book? Like, or is there a break between player versus DM information? Or like, what are you expecting?
What we're going to do is the Gazetteer will have those 6 pages of comic book at the very beginning of it, or running through. You know, it might be, you know, here's a page of comic book, here's a page of text, here's a page of comic book. You're not sure about how we're going to do that yet, but it's going to have the 6 pages of comic book in there, but it's also going to have standard Gazetteer type stuff, sort of at the level of Greyhawk. You know, here's the country, here's the ruler's title, here's a quick description of what goes on in that country, moving on to the next country, and then possibly a list of... I can't speak really clearly about the Gazetteer because that's coming after I've written the main book, so that I can then take out, you know, bits. But I don't want to write something in the Gazetteer and then discover that I've contradicted myself in the main book. So the organization of the Gazetteer is not entirely clear yet, but it's, you know, so it will probably have some of the factions. It'll probably have some of the descriptions of the various gods that are in there, but everything's going to be pared down to the attention level span of somebody who just wants to play the game, and the ability to know what kinds of questions. If you are one of those magic user cleric who wants to learn a lot about the world, it gives you the threads to start pulling at of, these are the questions I might be asking NPCs, and these are the NPCs that I might be wanting to go to try and find it. So there will be a traditional Gazetteer with a lot of text information in it, but it will be very much pared down from the DM's version of it, which contains, you know, more information about what's going on behind the scenes. That one will contain, you know, a list of adventure hooks for all of the countries. It's both Osric and Swords and Wizardry side by side. So first edition AD&D and OD&D side by side. So it does have new monsters. It has an NPC priest class, because in OD&D, and that's really only for Swords and Wizardry, but in OD&D, you can't have neutral clerics, but there are priests, and those are never defined, because it would be, you'd have to design a whole new character class for each and every one of these deities, a la what they tried to do in second edition. So that's sort of the organizational scheme that we're working with right now.
Nice. I mean, let me follow up on this issue of like your religion, your pantheons, and we started to get into this before we turned on the live show, actually. And you know, I was so over my years of gaming, I kind of have evolved, and most people know what the terminal point is for me, but I kind of evolved in like what I expected to see for like a pantheon, and like is it real world or not? And when I was a young kid, I think traditionally, like in school, you'd get a lot of Greek mythology. And of course, at one point, you know, people would teach Greek as one of the primary languages that all educated people have to learn. And as a result of that, you'd learn a whole heck of a lot about Greek and Roman mythology. When I was a kid, I feel like Norse mythology seemed like a novelty, like most people didn't know about that very much. And so I was like, oh, I could use this, and it's kind of real world, but people aren't going to recognize it. And then partly as a result of Marvel Comics building out the whole Thor mythology, that became a lot more well-known. And then there was a point where I thought that I was going to use a lot of Sumerian myth as my in-game pantheon, because again, kind of solid, sort of recognizable, but people don't immediately recognize all the names. And I kind of struggled with that for years and years about whether I should use a real world pantheon and how recognizable it should be. What are you doing with Jordova?
Well, all of the gods are new. They have names that are reminiscent mainly of mainly Sumerian, Akkadian, very ancient languages, Fertile Crescent area. So, you know, the god of mortal laws and kingship is Anku, for example, which is, you know, and I'm pulling a lot of sounds from Akkadian. I can't really pull sounds from Sumerian because no one knows what it sounds like, but you think you know what it sounds like because we've got letters for it, but they're arbitrarily put in there. So once again, you know, what I'm aiming at is this sort of Bronze Age, Iron Age feel to it rather than a medieval feel. And when I say that, I'm a little bit off because the north coast of the Coromandu Sea is pretty much like a European dark ages. And by dark ages, I mean like 500, 600, common era. So way before most people think of when they're talking about medieval, but it's still technically in the, but immediately post fall of the Roman Empire. And the idea with these gods is that, they have to, well, so one thing is, if you look at modern, by modern, I mean, even going back to first edition, the people have tended to equate alignment with gods, have gods, the gods are telling people the way that they should behave. None of that is really present in ancient mythology. The gods didn't really care what you did as long as you were anteing up sacrifices and worship and so on and so forth. They weren't moral. They weren't trying to tell you to behave in a particular way. But modern players really expect to be doing that. And so what I've done with the gods is I've said, okay, the gods themselves do not have alignments. They have personalities that may be, you know, so, you know, the dawn goddess is all about you know, protecting the weak and light and healing. So this is obviously a deity who you would say is of good alignment. But this same deity as a force of nature, so she's a goddess of good, which meaning law in terms of basic and OD&D. She's a goddess of good on the one hand. She is also independently a goddess of neutrality, because the Druids worship the forces of nature. They're neutral. This is a deity that's associated with Druidism as well. So for a lot of these deities, there are multiple alignment approaches within the priesthood itself, and the priesthood can end up in conflict with itself over the way in which that they're going to, you know, be presenting the god, or what the gods, you know, wants people to do. And so there, I think we pull in a more ancient sort of feel to the religions. And I haven't made them amoral, because that sort of then defeats the purpose, and you might as well not even have them. But what I have done is I've made the morality broad enough that it's not entirely clear what the god stands for. They stand for, you know, you've definitely got a list of things that they do stand for, but it's not necessarily alignment things. It may be things that are clearly linked to an alignment, but some of them it's not. You know, Voam, the god of magic, is a god of magic and something or else other, and flowers, because flowering, blossoming, you know, is god of magical forces. And so you know that, you know, flowers might be important. You know, what are you going to do when you come across a field of flowers and you're a cleric of Voam? You've got a decision to make, you know. So it's to make it, is to try and make it more ambiguous and again more new for modern players.
Nice. Do you I noticed that the like when I'm looking at literature, I find that a lot of if someone publishes for a number of years, a number of stories or game, or I'm thinking mostly literature here, they wind up at some point feeling compelled to justify the real world borrowings. And that can either be like this is a different era of the real Earth, right? So Howard does that, Tolkien does that, right. Jack Vance does that in the other direction, right? This is a much later version of Earth than we're used to with the Dying Earth series. Or it's, you know, this is all happening on another planet in our solar system. And, you know, Burroughs does that with John Carter on Mars or Barsoom. And Edison's Worm Orbis is technically set on Mercury or a counter Earth or something like that. And then you might do like a Lovecraftian thing where you have a very vast cosmos and you can potentially dimensionally travel to other worlds. And this explains why there's these recognizable earthly elements as they've transported here. I think on Jordoba, you have elements of like dimensional travel or incursions from other places. Do you use that at all to justify the borrowed earth elements, or does that come into it in any way?
No, I mean, the borrowed earth elements are just from my thinking, you know, when I'm doing stuff, I like to have a structure behind it. And so I'm borrowing a bunch of stuff. And what I do in the book, and I probably have done this in a bunch of other places too, is I'm fairly open about, hey, I borrowed this from such and such. Like, you know, when I'm talking about there's a word Kadim, which is basically the word for a neighborhood association in the city of Jordoba. And I point out this is the Akkadian, I think it's either Akkadian or Sumerian. I think it's Sumerian, actually. It's the word Ka, which is the word for gate, and Deem is the word for to tie. And so I just threw out that little, here's how I generated this made-up word from morphemes in Sumerian. And the reason that I do that is not to establish credibility. It's so that somebody who is using it, well, number one, so they don't trip over it, because you know, I hate it when I think something was made up and talk about it being made up, and someone was like, well, you know, actually that's from blah blah blah. But it's also so that if anybody wants to be using the same background materials, you know, so let's say that they, you know, want to, you know, make up another word, you know, in the language for the thing, it's, you know, okay, this one, you know, this one's coming from Sumerian, is how it's done, and here's what it means, and sometimes it helps to be able to answer the players, but it's mainly just so that the, you know, because I usually treat the DM kind of as an equal partner in the things that I write, you know, so I write as one DM to another rather than any of the other various approaches that people could do. You can get a campaign world where it's just, you know, here are all of the answers and that's the thing. And some people prefer to read something like that because everything's answered. Whereas I tend to be like, you could do this or you could do that or you could do this, which some people love and some people, you know, don't like. But as part of the you could do this, you could do this, you could do this, I'm usually sort of pointing out, here's where I got this from, so that you can, you know, look at the same thing.
Nice, nice. I think that makes a lot of sense on a, you know, hopefully shared campaign setting like this. I will confess that I've critiqued that sometimes in rules writing in the past, but I think that makes a lot of sense in something that's intentionally got a bunch of, you know, extra space that you expect people to add to. So that's, I like that a lot. When I write, I have a lot of footnotes explaining what I'm doing. So I try to be, so I respect that a lot. Let me ask this. I don't think I've heard someone say that. I really like this elevator pitch of comic swords and sorcery. Were you thinking at any point about specific comic series in the past that was inspiring to you?
Not other than Conan. I mean, I actually wasn't much of a comics reader when I was a kid, because I spent all my money on D&D stuff instead of on comics. you know, I read stuff that, you know, friends had, and that was mostly Conan. But I'm really not a super big comics aficionado or expert or anything along those lines. But the thing was that even with that very small amount of contact, the Conan comics were tremendously powerful imagery wise. You know, and I read the short stories to the Sprague the Camp, you know, long series where they filled in the gaps. But the comic books, you know, there's so much more power in visual imagery, and you know, and then realizing that, you know what, we could duplicate that, you know, by doing, you know, here's the, you know, the quick introduction to the history of the world, and it's in comic book form, and it carries a tremendous punch to it.
Yeah, yeah, and you're probably thinking like for, to me, you say Conan comics, I think of like 1970s Marvel Conan. And you've got like these great, great artists working on it, like John Buscema and people like that, Ernie Chan. Likewise, I wasn't collecting them, but boy, they made it. Every time I would see them, they made a big impact on me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like Matt, I'm not a huge comics guy either. And I know, Dan, you've probably got more background in this than either of us. So I'm kind of curious if this holds water for you. But I almost think that just like the very language of comic books, or the implication of something being in a comic book, brings a certain level of expectation of like kind of based on reality, but maybe an alternate universe or with like twists in it, rather than sort of quasi-historical, but also with, you know, or supernatural elements. Is that true? Or do you think comics are broader than that, and they offer some?
Well, I mean, you know, if you, I was hoping Matt would refer to the, you know, Conan Marvel series. It was long running, right? They covered a lot of territory. To me, it feels visceral and concrete. It's something that you can draw, something you can fill space in. It's not entirely just like wordplay. Like I almost feel like Vance's Dying Earth is slightly harder for me to imagine in illustrations, but the Conan stuff is very visceral. You get dropped into it. There's clearly threats and things, to physical things to stumble over on the ground and all that kind of stuff. You know, they even brought in Elric at one point. Like, there was a crossover where I think Conan met Elric, if I recall. So it has a big world.
Yeah. Well, let me bounce the question back at Matt in a kind of slightly different angle then. Matt, is there a reason, especially if we're just like specifically talking about Conan, is there a reason to focus on the Conan comics rather than the original short stories by Robert E. Howard? Like, what connotation does the fact that it's comic book carry for you?
Because for one thing, a comic book has its own authority. We were talking about, are you linking it, you know, to an old world or something? If it's in a comic book, you don't really need an explanation because you can see it right there. I see the pictures. So I believe it. So it's real. I don't really need to know exactly which planet this happens to be on. Maybe they'll tell me at some point. But, you know, I'm into the story on, you know, at the get-go. And that's, and D&D needs that a lot. You know, you get people thinking, you know, occasionally overthinking things. And that... Hey, you know, you're in a world and it's a sword and sorcery comic book. Okay. I don't need to know anything more about it. I'm in a world and it's a sword and sorcery comic book. I even kind of know what my guy looks like. He's drawn with lines and he's got, you know.
Yeah, I guess you're speaking to the same thing that Dan was talking about there, of that kind of visceral, like, I can see it, I can feel it, it's very tangible, right?
It's got weight.
You know, it's weight, and maybe even a little more action-oriented than, say, you know, a novel might be, right? A little less internal looking and a little more just like, oh, you're in the middle of the action right away from page one.
Now, I mean, obviously, sorry, I apologize for my dog. I've got power outages and dog barking. And, you know, I'm a bigger fan, like I mentioned, of the Conan fiction than I was of the Conan comic. They do two very different things by virtue of one of them being fiction and the other one carrying the punch of the comic book. And I think I relied less on... there's not very much in Jordoba that is really sourced from Howard, except probably there is the very beginning. There's a snake, a serpent people civilization that covers the whole world, and they get overthrown by their humankind slaves at the very beginning. Well, that serpent, and there's more detail to it than you get in Howard. You know, there's God Emperor snake things at the top. There's snake deities, and then you've got Nagas, and then under that you've got Ehinagas, which are basically the Yuan Ti, but you can't call it that, so they're Ehinagas. And then people who are involved, and that whole thing is very much based on Howard's Stygia. But interestingly, it's not what Howard would have thought he was doing. In his mind, Stygia was ancient Egypt. It did have stuff with snakes in it. But what he was doing was, this is a civilization that is so ancient that nobody even remembers when it started, and it sort of played the role of ancient Egypt, in the ancient world, where ancient Egypt was different from anything else because it had been around since anybody ever remembered. And, you know, it's still, I still love it when people point out that some of the archaeology that was being done during Cleopatra's day was digging up stuff that was older than Cleopatra is now. It was that long a progression in ancient Egypt. And I think that was really what Howard was mostly focusing on with Stygia. But the concept of Stygia is in here, and out of the various sources, I would say that's the only thing that I really took from Howard's fiction, as opposed to, but the look and feel coming from the comic books, that's all over the place.
Yeah. It's an interesting example of like how seductive Egypt is. There's so many interesting pieces there, and it feels in some ways disconnected from the European mythology we're familiar with, and how often, like sometimes I feel bad, frankly, about not being able to use, like feeling like I can't use Egyptian mythology or pieces in my games because I can't justify them being there. And the fact that Howard, like almost uniquely, you know, picked out Set as a deity that he needed to have in his Conan stories, even though you don't see the rest of the Egyptian mythology or stuff like that. So it's really interesting how much we're able to pick and choose out of those pieces. And maybe it turns into something a little bit different if it evolves a little bit, you know, maybe into Djordjal or something like that. Mm-hmm. Clever.
And my favorite, go ahead.
Well, I'm about to cut us off, Matt. Go ahead and finish your thought.
All right.
We are at time here.
Wow.
Matt, do you have any final thoughts about myth and legends incorporating into your campaign world, or as it applies to Djordjal specifically, or in general?
I mean, in general, it's the usual thing, I think, with everything, is that, you know, in the game, everything is geared toward designing adventures and making things work at the micro level of we're sitting down at a table and we're doing an adventure. Everything needs to be directed toward what is going to make the design process easier for me, or what's going to make the adventure flow more smoothly, or what's going to make the players the most excited when they are sitting down at the table doing the adventure. I think everything, you know, needs to be geared toward that.
Smart.
Dan, anything to add before we close out?
I agree that it's something that's worthwhile thinking about tastefully. And I'm personally excited to see the new edition of Djordjal come out. And other thoughtful fantasy world creations. And I'll remind our viewers that if you go to the YouTube description right now, we've got links to the free player's guidebook comic book that Matt has out right now, and also a link to the upcoming backer kit that's coming up in a couple weeks. So I hope you'll join for both of those.
Yeah, please go and sign up. Those pre-launch pages where you can sign up are very useful in estimating how many copies you're going to be printing, which is important for pricing. So anytime you get the opportunity to either say to somebody, yes, I am playing on Backing Mat, or no, I'm not going to, so I'm not going to do the thing, those are very helpful to people who are doing crowdfunding.
Nice. Awesome. Viewers, please do check out those links. As Dan mentioned, they're in the description of the video here. If you're watching live right now, I think I also saw Backweas post the link in the chat. So go ahead and do click on that and sign up if you're interested in updates. If you have thoughts about the larger context of the conversation about how to incorporate myth and legend from the real world into your campaign world, and where to draw the line, and when it adds clarity versus confusion, please leave us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will spin up a new conversation for Dan and I down the road.
Absolutely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites, so please look for us there and invoke that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. We're also available through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please consider giving us a 5-star review. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, conversation with the smartest, wisest, most charismatic patrons in all the land continues 24/7, round the clock, all the time. If I have questions or problems that I can't figure out, I rely on them to post a question. They've got like great possible resolutions for that. And we'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue this conversation on a live video after chat. So if you are a patron, maybe on the $1 tier, we're really looking forward to having you there. And of course, huge thanks to Mr. Matt Finch from Mythmere Games for joining us today. And maybe we can get Matt into that after chat, possibly, if he has time. Yeah. No obligation.
Yeah,
that could be fantastic.
I'll I'll be in the after chat this time. I only ever skipped it once, Dan. You're never going to let me forget. It was, I had something like the front yard was on fire or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was. But yeah,
No excuses, Matt. You got to be there.
This is Texas.
Fires and internet outages.
Exciting here.
Dog attacks. No excuses. So, Matt, thank you so much. We'll look forward to continuing the conversation in a couple minutes over our live after chat. Thank you so much. We are really excited to see the new iteration of the World of Jardoba. I love the Howard and comic influences and all that kind of stuff. So we'll keep an eye on that. And viewers, don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.